Welcome to my podcast on photography. My name is Ewan Bell. I'm an editorial and travel photographer based in Melbourne, Australia. I've been working for myself for over 25 years now, and I make this podcast to explore ideas and my thoughts that don't fit on my blog or on the YouTube channel. Are you ready to explore the art of photography today? Welcome to my channel, and especially a big welcome to any beginner photographers out there who are on a path to learning more about the craft of photography. This video is for you. I am trying to put myself in the shoes of someone who doesn't yet know what they need to know. I want to share with you some ideas about whether you really need to spend lots of money on expensive camera gear, why editing photos might matter to you, thinking about photography as an act of expression, and we'll even talk about light and why this matters more than anything else. My name is Ewan Bell, and I've been a professional photographer and mentor for over 25 years now. I have been lucky enough to travel the globe and enjoy doing what I really, really love. Before starting a YouTube channel, I published a book on photography, and I've shot for National Geographic. I run my own photography tours, and I married my favorite person in the world, who also happens to be a super wonderful photographer as well. I don't claim to have all the answers for you, but maybe I can help you find some better questions. We have a lot to talk about. This is going to be a long video, so make sure you have a cup of tea and a comfy seat. We got to talk about gear. We got to talk about how much gear you actually need. When I started reviewing camera gear, I used to get really excited to try out some of those amazing brands that I could only dream of owning. And each time I did a review, I found myself very disappointed. Again and again and again, I just found that these cameras aren't actually all that different. And when your job is to find 2,000 words to say about a camera that doesn't actually excite me at all, that's a tough job. These days, most cameras are great. There are no bad cameras out there. Having the right gear, the gear that matches my style and lets me take photos that express myself, well, that makes me happy. But it takes a path to get there, and that path is not necessarily a straight line. I think you have to go through the process of wasting money on some gear and getting rid of that excess baggage and paring down to only what matters for you. And we can enjoy that journey. We can accept that this is how humans and cameras will be. And don't be too hard on yourself when you decide to sell a lens you bought 2 years ago that's been sitting on the shelf doing nothing. Working out what camera gear will work for you is difficult. It's trial and error. Even with the benefit of endless reviews on YouTube, it is trial and error. And that's okay. It's okay to try something out and decide it's not for you. And trying things out is really important. I want to tell you about a lens that I bought very early in my career, and it changed everything for me. It was back in the days of DSLR, and I would usually only buy new gear when I had a shoot that would cover the costs. For example, one time I picked up a gig to shoot some wildlife in the top end of Australia, so I used my fees on that shoot to advance purchase a 300mm f2.8 telephoto and a new camera body to match the lens with faster burst mode, and I buy the gear for the job, and from that point forward, I have the gear to apply to my other jobs as well. As a professional, this is how I try to be sensible with my money. But that 300mm lens was not the lens that changed my career. No, it's not. Because my other policy was that every year I would buy myself something that was not a commercial decision. I would buy myself something that was outside my existing experience and just to experiment with it. And so I bought a 24mm f1.4 lens. And this seemed illogical for lots of reasons, not least of which because I already owned a 16-35mm that covers the 24mm focal length. So what was it about this lens that made it different for me? This was the lens that allowed me to experiment with shooting very fast aperture, to get shallow depth of field and to get nice bokeh, but also to shoot wide and pull in lots of context at the same time. It gave me the two most powerful elements for compositions in the same lens. And here's the problem. Most people will never buy that 24mm f1.4 lens because they don't yet know what it can do for them. But most people won't ever learn what it can do for them unless they buy it. But they won't buy it because they don't know what it can do for them. You can see why I call it the 24mm problem. Today we have such a great resource in YouTube, and maybe more people will be inspired to take that leap and to try a new bit of gear. But you won't really know for yourself until you give it a go yourself. It is impossible to escape the attention cycle of new camera gear. Every time there's a new release or some new technology and shiny new objects, but having the latest gear didn't make me happy. What I realized after a while is that the gear is not nearly as interesting as the photos. Ever since I was a kid, I have been told that photography is about documentary. It is evidence. The photograph is evidence, that the camera never lies, and that you can't argue with a photo. And I think the world has changed a lot since those ideas were prevalent. Indeed, today, we can never be sure if something is a photo or if it's something else. I want to step away from the idea that photography is about documentary. I want to step into the idea that photography is art. And what I mean by art, I'm not talking about it being some highbrow, important expression of mankind. I'm simply saying that photography is expression. You are expressing yourself with the camera, and you have an opportunity every time you pick up that camera. This is an opportunity for you to capture something and share that with the world, and in the process of what and why you share it. That is art. That is expression. It is always about expression for me. That is what motivates me to enjoy other people's photography, because I want to see what they want to share. Why did they think this image was worth sharing with me? That's what makes the photograph interesting. And as a photographer, the flip side is, what is motivating me to go out and take these photographs in the first place? And it's because the camera gives me a voice. It lets me say something. It lets me share my version of the world with a whole bunch of other people. When someone shows me their photos, or I look on social media to step into someone else's world, what makes the photo interesting to me is that someone decided that it was important enough to share it with me, that someone decided to capture that image in the first place, and there was a reason behind that moment. The photo itself is just an object, but the intention behind it is what gives it meaning. Sometimes we need to have it explained to us. Sometimes we can look at a photo and think, nothing much happening here. And then you read the caption, and suddenly what seemed like a very ordinary moment takes on a new light. The depth of that moment is transformed by the intention of the photo. I say intention of the photo, but really what I mean is the intention of the photographer, because it's their intention. The photo is a representation of intention. This connection between art and documentary comes up a lot, and sometimes we struggle with it. Sometimes we want to be accurate. You know, we lean into, how can I make this true and honest and accurate? And it almost suggests that art isn't accurate. You can be true and honest and be artistic at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive. And for me, the guiding principle is, everything is art. You can attempt documentary, but your perception of things, your choices, which side of the street you chose to photograph, all these things change what the image actually is. And if that's the case, everything is art. And if everything is art, lean into it. Really, really lean into it. Because the intention of the photographer is so important to me, you can understand that I have a lot of objections to AI-generated images. Just to be clear, I have many objections when it comes to AI, but there's a fundamental hollowness to even the most impressive AI image, because it doesn't come from experience. It's the opposite of meaningful because all the reasons and all the experience and expression have been stripped away at great expense to render out a hollow image that has no connection to reality. AI is a paradoxical moment where the world's most intensely wasteful use of resources is given to the world's most careless and lazy minds. You end up with an image that doesn't exist, an image that never existed. It was created at the will of someone who didn't want to take the photo. So yeah, not a big fan of AI. We often think we need to know a lot more than we actually do. And I think photography is a bit like driving a car. I know how to use the shift. I know how to use the wheel. There's a couple of buttons there that I might need to hit in an emergency. But mostly, I have no idea what is happening under the hood. And there are some people who want to change the oil on their cars. There are some people who will change the whole engine because they want to know more about cars. But that doesn't mean you have to be that person in order to drive one. And it's the same with cameras. I try to break this question down into technical versus creative. So there are things that we can learn that are technical, like how the f-stop works or how a particular lens operates. And those technical understandings can help us be more creative. It's like you're adding a tool to your toolkit. So each time you learn something technical, you're stepping forward a little bit, and that's a positive. But that's not the same as saying you need to learn everything, and you just don't. You don't need to know everything to drive your camera. But I really want to encourage you to not be too confronted by the complexity of cameras and try to stick to the enjoyment of photography. My wife is also a photographer, and she is not especially technical. She doesn't enjoy the technical side of it. I am the technical one and she is the creative one. And oftentimes we actually bring our skills together to find a new way for ourselves to capture scenes for our clients. Neither approach on its own is going to get us as far as bringing these two halves of our capacities together for the task. My guess is that if you're trying to learn more about photography and you're here listening to me, then what you're really looking for is how can you better be in control of the camera? And so there are some technical aspects that are going to help you be in control. You will want to understand exposure and you will want to get a handle on shutter speed and aperture and ISO. And somehow from these three simple elements, we get such immense complexity and endless variation in photography. And we will go through those things later in the video. I will get into those details. External inspiration, I think, is a really big deal. And it's not just about other photographers. You might get inspiration from late 18th century painters. I used to walk the rooms of our National Gallery as a young person and just marvel at the texture and detail in the oil paints. If you get close enough, you can see the actual physical impressions of the blade as it presses into the oil on the canvas. The act of painting is wonderful. It's like a mirage. It only makes sense once you step back and take in the full picture. And sometimes with photography, we can get caught up in the details and we can miss the bigger picture. I want to take a quick break from things so that I can ask you to hit that like button and maybe leave a comment below to share your thoughts about starting out on your photographic journey and what it is that you are struggling to learn. If you think you might enjoy more videos from me, please hit that subscribe button. Or even better, why not pop across to my website and subscribe to my monthly newsletter. Each month I share updates on new videos, new workshops, and link to the monthly zine that I put out. This is available to read online and requires no login or sign up. It's just there to enjoy and celebrate some photographic inspiration. Finally, I should mention that each year I run a handful of workshops and tours in various parts of the world. Please pop onto my website to take a look at ewanbell.com. Let's talk about editing your photos, because lots of people just don't want to do this. And I don't know whether we're just getting lazier because we live in a world where we have all these different things that make our life better. Like, I don't want to wash the dishes. I'm going to use the dishwasher for that. Some folks say you don't have to edit, and sure, you don't have to, but you're missing half the point and you're missing most of the camera's capability if you're not editing the raw file. Before I get too deep into editing, I do want to discuss the difference between raw files and JPEGs. JPEG files are basically an open standard that the entire internet uses. When I upload a photo to Facebook, it's a JPEG file. JPEG is great for sharing, but it's not so great for editing. It is compressed and it is a flat file, meaning what you see is what you get. Raw files contain a lot of extra data, and I think of these like layers of data. And with the right editing, you can step through the layers and pull back that detail that you otherwise can't see. Don't just think of raw as maximum quality. You got to think of it as maximum creative potential. The raw file is just a very, very flexible starting point for your image. When we talk about editing a RAW file, it's important to note that the RAW file itself is never changed. We open the RAW, we tinker with some edits inside our RAW editor, and then we export out a JPEG later that we can post to Facebook, or we can use it to print into a real book. If you're old enough to remember the days of film and remember when you used to go to the chemist and take your film to the chemist, and the chemist would put it through a machine or send it to a lab, and that's what photography was back then. And if you're just using the JPEG mode on your camera, you are doing the equivalent of taking your roll of film to the chemist. Yes, you need some software to edit. You need a computer to do it. Half of photography is hard drives and editing your RAW files. But you don't actually need a whole bunch of grunt and power. And I'm still running an old MacBook M1 Air from 2020, and it's great for editing photos. You do need some good software though. There are two ways to think about editing photos, so I want to talk a little bit about that. The first is to do it one by one, such as how some folks might use Photoshop or Affinity. This is a careful and demanding way to edit your photos. It's great if you want to immerse yourself in one image and really tweak it. The other way is called RAW workflow. That's where you take hundreds or even thousands of RAW files, you put them into your RAW workflow editor. Different kind of software. You're looking for the good ones and you're looking to tweak them, and then you simply discard the rest. You are working very quickly through a very large set, and the changes you make to one of them, you can very quickly apply to a whole bunch of others. This is great for me as a professional photographer because I need quality, but I also need speed. Lightroom is one example of a RAW workflow editor, but Adobe charges subscription every month for the rest of your life. Or for $200, you can buy something like DxO PhotoLab and just keep using it until you really want to upgrade to a newer version. I bought my license back in 2022 and it's still good. It's still doing what I need. And I do have a video on that and I will link to that below if you want to follow. I'm not going to teach you how to do editing in this video. I have other videos for that. I just want to make the case that editing is good. Editing is part of the creative process and it's most enjoyable when you have good software. Try to remember the camera sensor can see a lot more than what appears on the back of your screen. To access all of that information, we need to get intimate with the RAW file. Editing is not a challenge to spend as much time as possible working on an image. That's not the world I want to live in. It is about being intentional with your processing style. It is the opposite of, can I get it right in camera? And I do not like that expression because that suggests there's only one right. That suggests there's only one version of that photo that you're ever going to want. And that's just not the way it works. You don't need to do much with most photos, but just bringing out the full potential of an image with a little bit of time to contemplate your creative options, I think that's worthwhile. This will be short. I might make some people cranky by saying this, but whenever someone asks me on a workshop, do I need to bring a tripod? I think the correct answer is, if you need to ask, then the answer is no. There are specific techniques which require a tripod, and they will be obvious once you start using those techniques or once you start investigating using those techniques. I do own plenty of tripods. I use them for video. I use them for slow shutter stuff when I'm down at the beach or doing a waterfall. What else do I use them for? We don't really use them for food photography very much. Sometimes if we have a very detailed product shot and we just don't want to reset all the time, we're going to set things up on a tripod because we might be doing the same shot for an hour. But that's not a common scenario for us. You will know when you get to a point when you need to buy a tripod. All I will say though is that most people end up buying a cheap and terrible tripod and they hate it and things don't go well and they often decide they don't want to use a tripod ever again. And it's the end of a whole photographic journey for some people. So when you hit that point of needing a tripod, please go and buy a good one. Please spend at least $400 on a decent tripod and head, because when you buy a good one, it lasts much, much longer than any of your cameras will. Kind of feels a little bit naughty to suggest that taking photos with your phone is fine. I don't think there's actually too many people in this world who don't think that a phone is a perfectly good camera. I think there's often this manufactured competition where, as a photographer, you're supposed to not like phones and you're supposed to say bad things. And it's not actually like that. All the photographers I know are really happy to take shots with their phone if that's the camera they got on there. And they understand that for some people, a phone is the best camera they're ever going to have. And indeed, for lots of people, the phone is the most sensible camera that they should have. Most people are not going to get value out of a bigger camera because they're not going to do the work. A phone is easier. A phone has a better user interface. You can easily make edits to it on the screen. It's great for immediate sharing. There are so many reasons that shooting on a phone is good. The phone technology has come a long way, and it's possible to get some reasonably good quality out of those very tiny little sensors that they pack onto the phone. And at this point, you might be asking yourself, why shoot with a camera at all? Now, cameras are slower, but they're also more intentional and they usually give you more creative options. They will give you higher quality, but really the whole thing with shooting with a camera instead of your phone is that you're in control. It is about that creative control. It is about choosing the f-stop, choosing whether you're using a shutter priority or a different priority, and we will get into that. You are in control and you have lots of options for control. You can put on a wider range of lenses because lenses do the work, and we'll get into that. And I think this is probably a good moment to get into the difference between doing photography for enjoyment and doing photography as a career. If I'm doing photography for fun, what camera do I want? And that's a totally different question to what gear you might need for your professional work. And there's a convergence happening in the market. The cameras that professionals use are getting smaller and smaller, and the cameras that non-professional use are getting better and better. The gap between professional and consumer has never been so small. So don't feel bad if you've decided that your photographic journey will only go as far as an iPhone. Because one thing that professionals understand, and maybe not everyone else has really thought about this, but camera brands are working very hard to convince you to upgrade their gear. They want you to buy new cameras all the time, and it's pretty rare that they come out with new features that actually make the upgrade worthwhile. Most of the time, you don't need to buy the latest model, and you can save a fortune just by buying last year's model. And of course, the dirty secret is that the cameras aren't doing the work, the lenses are. That's what we're going to talk about next. It used to be that as a professional photographer, I would make a point to spend more on my lenses than I do my cameras. But these days, there's so many really, really good lenses out there at a really, really cheap price. Things are a little bit different as a professional. You do spend more, you do buy different level of quality, and sometimes you are spending a lot more to get just a little bit better performance out of your lens. The great advantage to having a camera with interchangeable lenses is that you can choose what kind of lens that you want to shoot with, and most of the kit lenses, so the lens that comes in the box with the camera, kit lenses are generally not so impressive. They are functional, they cover a reasonable wide range, and they're not very fast. And by fast, I mean how much light do they let in, and that's where we're talking about aperture. An aperture is just the size of the hole where the light's coming through. If you have a lens that can go to f2, that means it's a very wide aperture. It lets in lots of light. We call that a fast lens. If you have a lens that's not very fast and it's got a very small aperture, so maybe f5.6 is as wide open as it goes, then that's called a slow lens. And as a general rule, the better the lens, the faster the aperture. That's one of the things we are ranking the quality of a lens on. When you're shooting at f2, you have a big wide aperture, but you have very shallow depth of field. And if you see this recording right now, I'm shooting very wide open. I'm shooting with a big wide aperture, and that means a small f-stop. So I have very little depth of field. So everything behind me goes all kind of soft, and it's out of focus. Each lens has its own characteristics, and this goes beyond merely what aperture that it can go out to. You get different characteristics of flare when the light hits the lens, and some people really enjoy working with flare and bokeh, and some people don't. The thing you need to know is that it's the lens that does the work. If your lens only goes to f4, you're not going to be able to shoot at f2. The sensor in the camera is what records the image, but it's the lens that makes the image. And this is why shopping for lenses is still fun, even if you have an older camera. If you are absolutely new to photography and you're not sure why you should go for one lens or the other, there are two main characteristics that I want you to think about. The first is whether it's a zoom or a prime. Your prime lens means it does one focal distance. It's either wide or it's standard or it's telephoto. And it just does one of those. It's just a fixed focal length. Whereas a zoom lens can move between two different points. And that's what makes a zoom a zoom. So if you get something like a 24-70, when you're shooting at the widest angle it's got, it's 24 millimeters, and at the longest telephoto is 70. Zoom lenses are very convenient, but prime lenses are easier to build for quality. So there's always a trade-off between zoom and prime. The fundamental thing that makes a lens useful or not is going to be how wide or how telephoto the lens is. And I like shooting wide. I really like wide. And when we say wide, we mean wider than standard. And when we say standard, we means what does the human eye see? 50 millimeter is what I think of as being a standard lens. And that's because the human eye sees the world in kind of a 50 millimeter perspective. That's how we see the world. Whereas your wide lens sees much more than that. Your wide lens goes out to the periphery of your vision. And so a wide lens could be something like 16 millimeter. 16 millimeter is ultra wide. It's very, very wide. And it means an image can pull in much more than you would see with the human eye. And then there's telephoto. And telephoto you can think of as just having a bit more reach. So telephoto will show you what's happening a long, long distance away. I think for most people, the prime versus zoom is the fundamental challenge that they're going to have. Why do I want to spend money on a prime lens that can only do one fixed focal length when for the same money, I could buy a zoom that does a bunch of stuff? And that really comes down to quality. What quality are you looking for? And the more experience you get with photography, the quality will matter more. And you might find yourself buying more expensive lens and buying prime lenses. But when you're starting out, it doesn't really matter. You're just going to use the lenses you've got because you're learning about photography. You're not learning to fill up your shelf with lenses. You guys are doing really well. Maybe it's time for a second cup of coffee, huh? Talk a little bit about exposure now, and I debated with myself whether this belongs in the video or not, because you can get caught up in the weeds. This is where we're starting to get technical with the art of photography. I do think it helps to have an understanding of how your camera is exposing the image, but I don't think you need to get too caught up in it. I don't think you need to be manually setting exposures in your camera in order to be good at photography. There are three things that impact the final exposure every time you take a shot. There's shutter speed, there is aperture, and there is ISO. And each of these can go up and down and can set your exposure up or down. When you adjust your shutter speed, you are changing how much light is coming into the camera, and that changes your exposure. So a shot at 1/100th of a second has more light than a shot taken at 1/1000th of a second. And the same thing happens with aperture. If you are shooting a shot at f8, you are letting in a lot less light than if you are shooting it at f2. ISO changes your exposure as well. If you have an ISO of 100, then you are setting the sensor to be less sensitive to light than at ISO 10,000. And the reason I didn't want to get too caught up with exposure in this video is that to a certain extent, it doesn't matter because the camera is handling it. The camera is doing the heavy lifting for most people anyway. Most of the time I am shooting with my camera in aperture priority, and I want to shoot at f2 because I like the bokeh, just like you're seeing here right now. And then the camera is deciding what shutter speed and what ISO should be used to make the exposure correct. Let's look at how that might work in practice. If you are on a bright sunny day and there is lots of light, then what's going to happen is the ISO can be down low at the minimum, and the aperture is going to be wherever you set it, and the shutter speed is going to be high. The shutter speed is high because there's just a lot of light and the camera's got to bring it down a little bit to get the exposure correct. And that's a very different situation for when you're shooting in candlelight in a very, very dark room. And the problem there is that there's not enough light, and even with your aperture wide open, the ISO probably has to go very, very high in order to make sure you have a shutter speed that's fast enough to be sharp. And there are times we might want to override the camera's metering of light. If we're shooting with flash, the camera doesn't yet know how much light is coming in, and so that's an example of when we need to override the camera's exposure mechanisms. The important thing that I want to mention with regards to exposure is ISO. Because you shouldn't think of ISO as changing the camera's exposure. ISO is changing the sensitivity to light for the sensor. It's like you're changing the range through which the exposure will take place. And that's a little bit different. So the ISO sets your potential range. Once you appreciate that the camera is trying to balance exposure for you, the next step is for you to have the option to step in and direct the camera to change the exposure to suit you. This is useful when you're shooting in complex light and there's lots of shadows, or if you're shooting back into the sun. Do you want a silhouette, or do you want to expose for a subject that's in the shadows? And there are two ways that I like to control exposure, either by locking it or compensating it. Exposure compensation is simple. You have a dial to add a little bit of exposure and make things brighter, or you can go the other way to darken it down a little bit. When you set exposure compensation, it's taking whatever the camera thinks is correct and it's shifting it up or down. When you want to lock your exposure, you're using the Auto Exposure Lock, or AEL, and this is a favorite way of mine to work with exposure. It allows me to quickly respond to a wide range of complex situations, and it lets me get my exposure in the ballpark. If my camera is metering the scene too dark because there's something bright in there that's throwing the exposure, then I look for a darker patch of the scene, and I point my camera there, and I get a lock. And once I've got my lock, I can move the camera to reframe the shot that I want, and it's holding that exposure where I had asked it to. In situations where the camera is metering too bright for me, then I would do the opposite. I would look for a brighter part of the scene and get a lock on that instead. Some cameras have a dedicated exposure lock button, and it's often marked with an asterisk. And some cameras are not designed to really push the AEL feature at all, and you have to work a little to hunt through the menus to find this feature. I should add that some folk get really into the maths of exposures and f-stops and the exposure triangle. Yes, it's important if you really want to understand what the camera is doing, but just like what I was saying before about how much you need to understand to drive your car to get to work every day, you don't need to know everything about how this stuff works. You need to know cause and effect, and you need to be in control. So long as you're in control, I am happy. One of the whole advantages to having a proper camera is having access to different drive modes and different lenses. And the big four modes are PASM, and P stands for program mode, and that's just sort of a way of saying auto. A is for aperture priority, S is for shutter priority, and M is for completely manual. I think the Canon still use TV for shutter priority, and in my brain, I think of that as time slice. P is for program, A is for aperture, S is for shutter, M is for manual. My thinking for drive modes is pretty simple. There are times when I want a lot of depth of field, as in I want everything to be sharp, and this is good for landscapes, say when you're shooting at F10 instead of F2. And working in aperture priority as your drive mode is really helpful here. You set the aperture to F10 because that's where you want it. That's what the priority means. And then sometimes I want as little depth of field as possible, and I'm going to use aperture priority for that as well, but I'm going to set it to F2 so that I get that nice soft bokeh effect with stuff in the distance being out of focus. But what if I want motion blur? What if I want a really slow shutter instead? And I want to set a specific shutter speed that I can get motion blur in my shots. So that's where I would shoot with shutter priority and say set my speed to 1/30th of a second. And then there are times when I want to avoid motion blur, and that's usually with wildlife because they move fast and I want to freeze the action a little bit so I can get a clear shot. And I can use shutter priority for this as well, and I can set my speed to 1/2000th of a second in order to get a good shutter speed. And here's where it gets a little bit confusing though, because cameras now have the option to set a minimum shutter when you are in aperture priority mode. And that just means you can achieve very slow or very high shutter speeds without changing the drive mode to shutter priority. The other complication is sometimes we might shoot in completely manual instead of aperture or shutter priority. We do that typically in any situation where the light is constant and we don't need to reassess the exposure for every shot. That example of shooting landscapes I mentioned earlier, well, that can be done in manual. And some people just like to be in control, and manual is great when you want to be in full control. I really want to stress though, that as a beginner, you absolutely do not have to be shooting in manual mode. And I want to stress it because sometimes experienced people will tell you that if you're not shooting manual, you're not doing real photography, or you're never going to learn to do real photography if you're not shooting manual. And this is bollocks. This is absolute bollocks, because do not let anyone tell you you have to shoot completely manual. I think it's good to be in control, but you can be in control with those automated modes. For some people, the joy of photography is more connected when they shoot manual. They like that control and they like seeing the light in this way. For other people, such as myself, letting the camera do some of the boring stuff, that is just great, because the camera will do a good job and it will get me close enough that I can fine tune it in the raw file, and I can be thinking about my composition and why I'm out there taking photos and thinking less about the camera. We could reframe the question of which mode to shoot in a different way. Most people shooting with a phone or camera are shooting in full auto anyway. They let the camera just take a photo and it decides everything. And so it's valid to ask yourself, when do I actually need to step out of auto and pick up a drive mode instead? Because if you don't have a reason to do that, then maybe you don't have a reason to do that. For me, I'm going to be shooting everything at F2 because that's just my jam. So I'm going to be in aperture priority. I'm going to be shooting wide open. And every now and then I'm going to step off that. But I have my baseline. I have my standard setup where most of my photography takes place.
Don't cry when I read these words. I've tried a thousand times before, but nothing, oh, nothing.
Let's talk about composition, or as someone put it, why do my photos look boring? This really could be its own video. It really is. There's a lot to cover with composition. I do have a presentation that I do for camera clubs about this, and it is a very, very long presentation. I really wanted to talk about composition here in this video because, in a way, composition is what separates the idea of taking a photo from making art. How you compose matters. It's how we use the camera to control what our audience ends up seeing, what goes in, what stays out, and how we arrange the elements inside the frame. I think of composition like intention. What matters in the photo? What can I do to build composition around what matters? I start by deciding what is the hero of the shot. I pick one hero. Not five, not two, not 20, just one. It's got to be one hero. Let's think about group photos for just a second and think about how boring group photos are. They're just lots of people and a big wide scene, and there's not much going on, right? There's no story there. It's just, oh yeah, we got to take a group photo. Now think about what happens if you isolate just one person in a group. Now we're doing some composition. This works for any subject, not just people. Decide what the subject is that matter. And it could be a tree, it could be a mountain in the distance, it could be a train coming through a scene, but you decide what really matters and then you start bringing more into the scene. So it's not just the subject. It's not just how do I get a photo with just my subject in it. That's not composition, that's isolation. You want to build a scene around it. You want to bring in more elements. So this is my starting point for composition. Pick your hero, and this is where F2 can be really helpful, because you can bring in other elements to a scene, but you're still keeping them soft. Just like you can see that I'm here inside my studio, but I'm the only thing that's in focus in the scene, and that's where your eyes keep landing. Everything else in the scene is complementing the subject, but it's not competing with it. there are lots of rules for composition out there, and I don't pay too much attention to rules. They define where you end up more than I think where you start. And my starting point for me is, what is the hero of the shot? What is my subject? What matters in this scene? And then I want to see what else I can bring into that moment that connects with my subject and gives me some context and tells some of their story. So to answer the question of why are my photos boring, it's probably because you haven't decided what your photograph is about, or you are pushing in and just showing the one subject and you're not showing the bigger scene. And it is very boring shooting everything that is tight and just the person. And this is one of the reasons that I don't like telephoto lenses. I don't use telephoto lenses very much. They are necessary for wildlife because you can't get close enough to most wildlife. But for everyday stuff, I want as wide a lens as possible because I can bring in more of the story. I can bring in more of the scene. And by wide, I think 50 mil is the bare minimum. Like, that's a standard lens. And then you go to 35, and you can do a lot with a 35 millimeter lens. You can get composition with a 35 millimeter lens. You can work that a little bit. And then you get to 20 millimeter. That's a beautiful perspective for lots of street photography. And the wider you go, the more context you're bringing in, because it's about your subject and what else you can bring into the story. That's composition. Can't talk about photography and not talk about light. In truth, light is the only thing that matters. Cameras don't see subjects, they only see light. It doesn't matter what camera or lens you shoot with. If you don't have the right light, you're not going to get the shots you want. If you want to take better photos, you need better light. What is good light and what isn't will depend on a lot of things. Different people have different ideas on this, and it varies a lot with what style of photography you're looking to work with. But in practice, if I don't have good light, I'm not going to take the photo. I just don't take photos in bad light. What you want is to cultivate seeing the light and seeing how light is different, and how different light changes your exposure, how it changes your compositions. What is good light and what is bad light will depend a lot on the person and what style of photography they are into and what influences they're pushing towards. Let's imagine you're standing on a street corner on a sunny winter's day and you have the opportunity to shoot in any direction you like. And which direction you choose, whether you're going with the light or against the light, will totally change the photo. And if you stand on that street corner and you just look and see what the light is offering you, how does it look different when you have the light to the side instead of in front of you? And how does it look different when you have the light behind you instead of to the side? And how is this light changing the scene? It may surprise you to know that I don't like having the light behind me. I always want my light to the side or shooting into it at least a little bit. And growing up, I was always told you have to have the light behind you. And I don't know what was going on there. It's like everything is so much more interesting when there's an angle to the light, because the light is how we are getting contrast. The light is bringing the color out of a scene, or if you're shooting back into it, you are washing the color out of a scene. And you, as a photographer, you get to decide how you want to shoot with the light. This is how you are controlling the whole process of what the camera sees. When we're in the studio, we control the light. We use a great big setup like this softbox, and we make the light look nice and strong and abundant, and we're in control. When I'm doing travel photography, that's totally different because I have to either wait for good light or I have to move my subject to somewhere where there is good light. In reality, I go looking for where the light is good and I look for subjects in that good light. I don't start with the subject and then try to find light. I start with light and try to find subjects. If you really want to learn about photography, if you really want to be a photographic expert, you start with light. You look for what light makes you happy. You look for how light changes a scene, whether it's the clouds or the seasons or the weather or the angle of it coming down a particular street. You look closely when you wander the streets of a city and you notice how the light on one side of the street to the other can offer a different experience. If a camera is like a paintbrush, then light is paint itself. The camera can't do anything without the right light. My foundation for all of my photography is very simple. I go slow, I get closer, and I look for the light. Those are the three things I always come back to. Whenever I find myself getting lost in a moment and I feel uncertain or confused about what I'm taking photographs and how my compositions are working or if they're not working, and I can be standing on that street corner and I think to myself, I have no idea what I'm shooting here. And that's when I know I need to look for the light. That is my cue to say, look for the light. This is not a metaphor. This is not some sort of surreal abstract reference. This is real. I literally look and turn around and I look for where the light is hitting in a certain way or is doing something interesting, where a street is being lit up and what subjects might be on offer, wherever the light is doing something special. I look for the light. I wanted to finish this video with a topic that really matters to me, and it's why I take photos. When I got started in photography, my goal was simple. I wanted to take pictures of what makes this world beautiful, because to me, the real world is full of beauty. And it's one of the reasons I'm no fan of AI-generated images, because it feels like some tech bros have simply never learned to appreciate the beauty of the world as it really is. And AI-generated images are just the opposite of the real world and everything that's beautiful in it. It also suggests to me that these tech bros don't appreciate the beauty of humans to make art, but that's another video. Wanting to capture something beautiful is how I got started in photography. Making something beautiful is the reason that I'm still here. And there's a difference. There is a distinction there between what you capture and what you make. I love taking a scene and working the camera to extract something unique through the lens, something that didn't exist until that moment. The photo is art. It is always art because it's your version of reality. And so because it's always art, I want to lean into that. I want to lean into the art. I take photographs so I can make something beautiful from the reality around me and I can call it my own. My favorite thing is when I take a photo that I didn't know existed until that moment, when the light surprises me and what pops through the lens is something unique that I'd never seen before. I see photography as something we tackle in two different modalities. There's trying to capture what is beautiful and what is inspiring. And I think that is usually our entry point when it comes to photography. Our focus in the moment is to take a photo that represents the subject or the mood or the emotion. But maybe at some point we move beyond that and start looking to create something unique from the beauty we see, to create a photo that is connected to the subject, and yet it brings together not only the reality of our experience, but it includes a little bit of ourselves in there too. Something that reflects our own perception and experiences, something that's really unique and that only you could have captured. And that is the difference between shooting for documentary and shooting for art. And I would argue everything is art, whether we like it or not. So why not lean into it? I think that's a good spot to leave it for today. Thank you for joining me for this conversation and for hanging through the video. Please do hit that like and subscribe as always, and check out some of my other videos on here. I have a few specific techniques and ideas on photography. It's not all just camera reviews and gear. And I hope to see you on my channel again sometime soon. Have a great day. Thanks for joining me today. I really love when my listeners reach out and drop me an email or say hello. Please let me know if you're out there somewhere. I have a monthly zine that you can enjoy on my website. There's no tracking, there's no sign up. You just click on the PDF and enjoy it. Plus my YouTube channel as well. And of course, I run a few workshops and tours in the Himalayas, the Arctic, and Australia each year. You can find all these things on my website at ewanbell.com. Have a great day.